by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is Bird Note. Polar bears symbolize the icy landscapes of the far north like no other animal. The bear's way of life, its very survival, is inseparable from the Arctic pack ice. Less familiar is a remarkable bird that shares with the polar bear this vital link to ice, the ivory gull. Just as polar bears are clad in white fur, ivory gulls are feathered entirely in white, adapted to the whiteness of their world. Long-winged and graceful in flight, ivory gulls breed on the northernmost islands of the Canadian Arctic and other high Arctic sites. They spend the winter near the pack ice. The gulls feed on small fish and other marine life, but also scavenge carcasses, including those left by polar bears. As a polar bear consumes the choice parts of a seal, ivory gulls wait at the edge of the action, intent on sharing the leftovers. Global warming has brought increasing change to the world of ice-dependent species, such as the ivory gull and polar bear. This white gull, like the white bear, represents an entire ecosystem at risk, as the extent and the thickness of sea ice is decreasing. There's more on our website at birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
The Canadian Human Trafficking Hotline is now live to help victims and survivors get vital social and emergency services. If you need help or want to help stop human trafficking, call 1-833-900-1010.
Thanks for joining me today, Ryan Campbell of Fair Vote Canada. Maybe you can just introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about what Fair Vote does.
So, like you said, my name is Ryan. I'm actually a part-time student at SFU, and I'm also an engineer. I work full-time in construction as an engineer. I've been involved with Fair Vote Canada since around 2011, 2012. And Fair Vote Canada, we're a national campaign dedicated to adopting proportional representation for all levels of government across Canada.
Right. Pretty much all provinces, territories, and the federal government use the first-past-the-post system. Maybe you can just very briefly explain what that is for folks.
So first-past-the-post, it can refer to a few systems, but normally what we talk about in Canada is you have a single winner in a riding. So there's only one MP or MLA per riding, and you just mark an X next to whoever you like, and whoever gets the most votes wins. It has a few problems. One is that you can have a situation where a party or a group of candidates or whatever gets a majority of the seats without getting a majority of the vote. And you can get, there's been examples of 10, 12% of the vote, I think 13% in Quebec recently, where you get no seats at all. So it leaves large segments of the population underrepresented, not even necessarily the usual suspects, not just small parties, but like urban conservatives, rural progressives, people like that.
What are the shortcomings of the first-past-the-post system?
Well, I may have jumped the gun a little there, but yeah, I think really it doesn't reflect how people voted. And one MP or MLA, it's hard for them to really reflect the diversity of their riding. We're an increasingly diverse country, not just, you know, in any one aspect, but especially politically. And the minority groups don't get represented. Now, a lot of MPs and MLAs will say, well, I represent everyone in my riding. But the reality is when it comes to their vote in the legislature, which is, you know, what makes us a democracy, you can't vote for and against a budget. You can't vote for and against a particular piece of legislation. So it just fails to represent about half of voters.
Right. So, I mean, first past the post, the current system used here in almost everywhere in Canada, is not actually used very much in other democratic countries. The UK uses it, the US uses it, but not many others. So it's been a constant sort of discussion around this topic from groups like Fair Vote about the importance or the need for change. What makes the status quo so sticky?
Well, I think we have a saying, especially this time of year, that turkeys don't want to vote for Thanksgiving. I think that's a problem that, you know, there's winners and losers among politicians with proportional representation, not necessarily among voters. You know, certain politicians, if you come from an area that's very heavily electing representatives from one party, suddenly under proportional representation, your party goes from having for example, Liberals in Toronto having literally all the seats with half the vote, suddenly, you know, you might be getting 55% of the seats, 60% of the seats. That presents a risk to you. So there's that issue. And the reality is that people have an interest in the system that elected them, unfortunately. So parties will look at proportional representation as great when they're in opposition, and then they kind of lose enthusiasm the longer they're in government, unfortunately. That's one problem. I think the other is that we're not taught about this in schools. Like the civics education doesn't cover the voting system. In fact, the way I was taught, and this was a while ago, actually teaches wrong information about the voting system. You know, you have your model parliament in class and everyone gets to be an MP. Well, that kind of is the logic of proportional representation where, you know, not everyone gets to be an MP, but everyone or most people, you know, in New Zealand, say 95% of people get someone they voted for as an MP. And that's not true under first past the post. It's like 50%. Right. So we're actually we're not teaching this to people. So I think there's an awareness issue. I think people kind of feel the effects of it, though, that they don't feel very satisfied with the results necessarily. There isn't a connection made between the voting system and the problems that people see just because of that education. And fair enough, right? Like people have only so much time. They're not going to go out of their way to read chapters and chapters about the minutia of voting systems.
So you mentioned, we've sort of touched on proportional representation, but what are the alternatives, alternatives that FairVote advocates for?
So we advocate specifically for proportional representation, and that could take a number of approaches. There's mixed member proportional, there's single transferable vote, there's list systems. There's a lot of technical terms I could go into for each one. I think the simplest one to explain would be a list system. So you might have four members in a riding instead of one. Maybe it's less in a rural area, maybe it's more in an urban area. And you get a quarter of the vote, you get one seat, whether you're a party or an independent. If you get half the vote, you get two seats, three quarters of the vote, three seats, and so on. And that's pretty simple to understand, I think. You also can have what's called an open list, where you actually vote for a candidate rather than a party. So the people that fill those seats are also directly accountable to voters. But there's a lot of ways you can do this. You can, what we're focused on is the principle that people should get what they voted for.
So you've mentioned some of the benefits and advantages. Are there disadvantages?
I don't feel there are, at least if you use reasonable forms of proportional representation that keep the number of MPs elected at one time at a reasonable level, and that keep a direct connection between voters and representatives. You have that direct link that if you don't like someone, you can just not vote for them. I think there's very few drawbacks for people. There's a lot of evidence that there's better healthcare policy, better environmental policy, stronger economic growth, better trade policy. All these things are connected to proportional representation because the incentives are different for the politicians. But it's the politicians, those are the, and a few connected, you know, lobbyists that want to lobby just one party rather than maybe multiple parties in a coalition. They're the ones that have the most to lose. Unfortunately, they're in a position of influence to decide to keep the status quo as well.
Right. In some countries working with a proportional representation system, there can be a sort of tendency for fringe parties to sometimes gain outsized influence in the system just because they're needed to form a coalition. Are there ways to protect against that?
Yeah, one is you have what's called a threshold, and so you might need a certain number of votes, like say 5% of the vote or 3% of the vote to gain seats. Others just you keep the riding sizes or region sizes smaller. So like my example of a 4-seat riding, you need about a quarter, actually in practice, more like a sixth of the vote to be likely to take a seat. That's still a big chunk of the votes, and that limits the number of parties you get. But I think the other thing that you can always do in any of these systems is the big parties can work together if there's a small party making outrageous demands or demands that aren't reflective of the majority. And we had an example of that at BC. The BC NDP wanted to proceed with liquefied natural gas development. Mm-hmm. And whether you think that's good or bad, the Greens didn't want to support that. And what they did is they made an agreement with the BC Liberals to get the legislation passed. So, you know, this concern about outsized influence of a small party, and frankly, the Greens weren't that small. They got, I think, 18% of the vote. That's pretty significant. Mm-hmm. But that's how the system, you know, whether you agree with that policy or not, from a democratic standpoint, that's how it should work, is that the major parties should be able to cooperate when they have common ground. And that's, you know, you see that in countries like Germany right now, for example. I think Denmark is doing that right now, too.
So FairVote recently has done a study of attitudes in BC on voting reform and possible alternatives. What did you hear from that?
Well, it was actually, if this is the there was a committee of the legislature that asked people to submit their views on the voting system, whether you're for proportional representation or against. About a little under 1,000 responded. In some way, but about 850 addressed actually the voting system specifically. Right. And of those 850, about 800, 93% said they want proportional representation. Another 5% said they want the existing single member ridings with a ranked ballot, which we don't think really solves fundamental problems here. We've used that in the past and scrapped it. And then another 2% wanted to keep first past the post. So pretty overwhelming support there. And it's a fairly significant number of responses. So there is an appetite in certain quarters for reform.
So what kind of things were, because it was individuals and also organizations participating in this process, yeah?
Yeah, so of those 850, I think 46 were organizations, and I think 43 supported proportional representation specifically. And that's, you know, it could be not-for-profits like ourselves. Yeah. It could be charities. It could be unions, for example. Quite a few responded to this.
What were people and groups saying in terms of why they were supporting proportional representation?
Well, I think everyone has their own reasons, potentially. Like, you might see it for a pragmatic reason, like I want better environmental policy or I want better labor policy. But I think the one that most people find the most compelling is just fairness, right? That it shouldn't matter where you live to how effective your vote is, right? If you are in Northern BC and you support the NDP, it's very unlikely you will get your vote count towards electing someone. And just like if you're in Vancouver and you support the Conservatives, you're very unlikely to have your vote count towards electing a Conservative, right? Only one out of 12, even though Conservatives got a third of the vote in Vancouver. So that kind of fairness, I think, is the most compelling kind of emotionally engaging argument. But there's pragmatic reasons as well.
So BC has voted three times, I think, on around this issue in recent decades, with various different results, but never quite enough to actually meet to get the change. Although I think the very first one did in fact come up as a majority, just not the 60% threshold. Why do you think that is? Why do you think there? I mean, there seems to be a lot of support. There seems to be a lot of arguments before it, but what's happening when this issue comes up towards a vote?
I think one issue is referendums aren't a good way to decide minority rights. And this is about minority rights. You know, all these groups, urban conservatives, rural progressives, Greens, these are minority groups. Yeah. And you don't really have the opportunity to kind of bargain in advance these minority groups' interests in a way that's fair in a referendum. I think that education issue I talked about earlier plays into it. We've got polls both nationally and in a couple of places, not specifically BC, but the national one I think is reflective that about 40% of people think that the current system is proportional. So it's hard to, you know, make an argument for proportional representation when people think it's the status quo, that's how this works. And again, you know, it's not anyone's, you know, fault for this, except that we're not teaching this, right? And people are not, you know, naturally drawn to go to like Wikipedia and read like 10 pages on voting systems. I think those are big issues for referendums. It's actually really a recent thing, this idea of a referendum on electoral reform. All other cases, like, because we've had a lot of electoral reform in Canada. We brought in the secret ballot in the 1870s. That was pretty important. Things like independent redistricting, the charter, which Section 3 of the Charter, universal suffrage, none of these things were done by referendum, with one exception, which is BC had a referendum on whether or not women should be allowed to vote. And that thankfully passed. But all other provinces just had a vote of the legislature. And a country that also had votes on referendums on whether or not women could vote is Switzerland. And that failed up to the 1950s and didn't pass until the 1970s. So you can see, you know, there's this gap of like 50 years between our trajectory and Switzerland on democratic progress. And I think most people would agree that was progress because they insisted on referendums here. I think there's also issues with the lack of accountability, too, that if, you know, politicians can say they support electoral reform, but not actually do anything to support a referendum, whereas a vote of the legislature, yes or no, is much more direct. If you want this policy, you know if your representative voted yes or no in a vote of the legislature. You don't necessarily know what they did in a referendum.
Where do you want to see this process or this issue going from here? What would you like to see happen now?
Well, what I'd like to see is proportional representation adopted. You know, they created this process, so they should, you know, if they're going to have this process, they should respect kind of the feedback they got. They chose it. But other things they could do, there's, you know, another new citizens assembly, I think would be productive. The BC Liberals have actually promised that in the previous referendum and then reneged on the promise immediately once the results were known. And the other is the Conservative vice chair of the committee talked about having municipal electoral reform, you know, try some of these systems out potentially at a municipal level first and give at least municipalities the option to take these systems. I think that would be very productive too.
You're an SFU student and you've been involved with Fair Vote, I think you said, for more than 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Why is this so important to you?
You know, I that's a hard question. I think I was radicalized as a student in my first undergraduate degree that I thought in our student elections that I had a student union at one level that used proportional representation. Yeah. And then I had at another level that used first past the post, and you got much more adversarial politics in first past the post than you did in the proportional system and less reflective of the students. So, you know, student elections have pretty low turnout. I don't know how reflective you're going to get in general. And it just, the more I dug into it, the more it made sense to me. Like, I think the arguments for proportional representation are really the same as the arguments for democracy itself, that the voters aren't going to be right 100% of the time, but they're more likely to be right than having, you know, like some kind of distortion of that. And you see in like BC, you know, the 1996 election where the BC Liberals got more votes than the NDP, but the NDP formed a majority government thanks to just the vagaries of where the election boundaries are. I was pretty young for that one, but I remember it distinctly, and that bothered me. And then the next election, NDP got almost wiped out and the Liberals got almost every seat. It really was formative that this is not working really for anyone.
Right.
I'd add to that too. Like, I think one thing is I feel just as a voter and an activist, I make too many compromises when I go to the ballot box, and I would like to be better able to express what I want in a more honest and nuanced way.
Right. Thanks so much for speaking to me today. Ryan Campbell is a representative for Fair Vote Canada and an SFU student. Thanks so much for talking to me today, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
If you're a regular listener of this show or other shows on CJSF, we'd love to hear from you. Tell us about what you like and why you like it, as well as ways we can improve our programming. To leave comments, please email cjsfprog@sfu.ca or call 778-782-4423. This information can also be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.
This is a CJY News Update. A Vancouver Island conservation organization is celebrating hitting a new milestone as the marmot population hits new peaks. In 2003, only 22 Vancouver Island marmots were known to exist in the wild, and the marmot subspecies faced a potential extinction. But now, 20 plus years later, the Marmot Recovery Foundation has broken a 400 marmot milestone. Adam Taylor, executive director of the Marmot Recovery Foundation, told CJY this was a milestone he never thought they would break and celebrate.
Recovery planning for this species first began in the late 90s. 400, you know, that was kind of a number that was often kind of thrown about as kind of like a dream. Well, could we actually get back to 400? So it's nice to be there.
While there is still cause to celebrate, the Vancouver Island marmot is still a critically endangered species. Taylor says that at the end of the field season in summer 2025, they were able to identify 427 Vancouver Island marmots living in the wild, the highest number ever since the species has been counted. He says his work has been done because of the recovery efforts and breeding programs done by the foundation and partnerships with the Calgary Zoo and Toronto Zoo. Taylor says right now a key improvement in their population growth has been a stepping stone methodology for releasing the marmots into the wild. The marmots will be released to an already formed colony at Mount Washington, where there is already a very high success rate, as people at the resort scare away predators. Resort goers will also be seen as a threat to the marmots, teaching the animals about protecting themselves from predators.
This soft release allows us to really give the marmots an opportunity to learn some of those skills about how to survive in the wild. And then we retrap them the following following year and translocate them to these far more remote sites where the risk of predation is quite real. And it makes a big difference to their ability to survive into adulthood.
As well, a supplemental food program for marmots coming out of their roughly 7-month hibernation period in the spring allows females in particular to have access to an abundance of high-quality food sources, with the hope it will encourage them to reproduce more frequently than they otherwise would. Taylor says when marmots are hibernating, they lose about 30% of their overall body mass, making them very weak when they emerge. Due to this, female marmots have a harder time gaining back strength to give birth, forcing them to give birth about every other year.
Last year, the marmots produced a record number of pups, 108 pups. We had never seen that many pups before in the wild, and we really anticipated a real step back this year because a lot of those females wouldn't be able to reproduce 2 years in a row. But in fact, we didn't see that at all. And this year, we ended up with 117 pups, so even more pups than last year. And we think some of that is attributable to that supplemental feeding.
Taylor says, while the news of the increase in marmots is exciting, he says there's still a lot of work to be done to continue to secure the current number and continue to grow.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but there is a part, I think, of us that is always waiting for the next shoe to drop. The population is still small. And we have had some luck over the past 2 years that is totally out of our control. So the weather the last two summers has been pretty much perfect for marmots. Unfortunately, that weather is, I mean, it's out of our control. And we know that not every year is going to be a good year. So, you know, there's this feeling of this, you know, it's really, really incredible to see the population grow, and it's really important too, because the next time we do have a bad weather year, whether it's heavy snow in the spring or a drought during the summer or, you know, whatever it is, you know, this provides that buffer for the marmots to absorb that hit, right? Because there will be a hit to the population when that happens.
But Taylor says there is still hope the marmots will again thrive on Vancouver Island.
I think it's really important for us to remind people that we can and are having a positive impact on species at risk. And the marmot, I think, is a classic example of that. Unfortunately, those examples are really rare. And in the world, over the past 30 years, there are roughly 14 to 16 mammal species that we can say conservation action has prevented that species extinction. And in Canada, there's only one, and that's the Vancouver Island marmot.
More information about the Vancouver Island marmots and how to donate to recovery efforts can be found on the Marmot Recovery Foundation website at marmots.org. For CHY News, this is Lauren McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
The art of the mixtape is not lost. Tune in to the Vancouver Mixtape for your own personal mix of Vancouver's best independent music, interviews, and more. Join me, Jesse, and my co-host Jamie on our trek through Vancouver's underground, Sunday nights at 8 o'clock on CJSF.
Hey, are you okay? It's okay not to be okay. That's why Kids Help Phone is available 24/7, 365 days a year, across Canada. So you don't have to deal with your feelings alone. You can text with a trained volunteer crisis responder or call a professional counselor, whatever works best for you. You can also connect with Kids Help Phone through trained interpreters in over 100 languages, and it's always free. Visit kidshelpphone.ca for more info and give your feelings a place to go.